Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tonight is the last night of Hanukkah, the Jewish Festival of Lights. And happy Hanukkah to all who celebrate. The Jewish population in Iowa has never been particularly large, but there have been Jews in the state since at least 1833, and of course, Jewish communities formed shortly thereafter. Later in the hour, I'll talk with historian Jeanette Gabriel about Jewish history in Iowa. But first, a first-person account of what it's been like to live as a Jewish woman in Iowa for the last 90 years. Joanne Satin has been a member of Temple Emanuel in Davenport since 1931. Temple Emanuel was founded in 1861 and is Iowa's oldest continuously active Jewish congregation. Joanne is on the line with me now. Hello, Joanne.
Hi.
Thank you
so much. Nice to be speaking to you.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you here, and happy Hanukkah to you.
Thank you.
Let's talk about your childhood. Go back in time just a little bit. I know that the temple was a very important part of your family life when you were growing up. Can you tell me what some of your earliest memories are of being there?
The building that the temple was using at the time that I was a child and started in religious school was on 11th and Brady Street. There was no parking that anybody could find, and it was very difficult to get to. But it was we had bought it as a church and renovated it, and it had a heating system where the pipes rattled all the time. But it was our synagogue, and we had Sunday school there, we had services there. It was a very, very nice place. A lot of my friends were married there.
Can you tell me a little bit about your family?
My parents, my father lived in this community all his life. My mother was born and raised in Chicago and came here when she married my father. My father took her to an Orthodox synagogue when they first were married, and she was appalled at it. And after that, we joined Temple Emanuel, which was Reform. And that was more to my mother's liking. I'm not sure that it was to my father's liking, but I think it was to hers. And we were members there. I have been a member there since I was five.
Wow. So tell me a little bit about the Jewish community in Davenport when you were growing up. I mean, obviously, you had your congregation at the temple. How large was the Jewish community?
The Jewish community was in its heyday in my parents' generation. It was very vibrant. We had a lot of members, and we were very active. And most of our members had businesses, large businesses. And the temple was the center of our not only religious life, but social life as well.
One of the reasons it was the center of your social life was not just because of this vibrant, warm, loving community, but also because of anti-Semitism. Tell me how that affected your family.
Well, we knew there were places that we were not welcome. That's all. And we didn't go there. And so that's why the temple was the center of our social life as well. Because we had many places that we knew we were not welcome.
Did your family talk about that when you were young?
My family talked about nothing. I mean, they never told me anything. All of my information is what I saw and felt or heard from other people. My family never spoke of it.
Can you tell me about what you saw and felt personally? Were there times when you felt unwelcome or discriminated against because you were Jewish?
It's just that I felt different. And I knew I was different. And I knew that all the Christmas celebrations in the schools, which there were lots of them, I knew that was not me. And so that didn't bother me a whole lot. I just knew that that's not where I belonged.
A number of my Jewish friends have told me over the years that people who are not Jewish make too big a deal out of Hanukkah because it's not one of your most important holidays. But we, outside of the Jewish community, make a big deal out of it because it happens at about the same time as Christmas. How was Hanukkah celebrated when you were a child?
That is absolutely correct. Hanukkah is not a major holiday. And it was celebrated low-key when I was a child. We lit a menorah. We ate potato pancakes for dinner one of the nights. And we got together with other family members. But it was very low-key.
Yeah, has that changed for you? I know a lot of Jewish families have embraced a bigger celebration of Hanukkah over time.
That has not changed for me. I still feel it is a minor holiday. And although I light a menorah and say the proper prayers, as far as I'm concerned, it's not a major holiday.
What's the most important Jewish holiday for you?
I would say Passover.
And why is that?
Passover is a family celebration. Everybody gets together. The meal takes days to fix. And we usually, all of my family get together at that time. And it is a home celebration. It is not a synagogue celebration.
Mm. Tell me a little bit more about your life at the temple, because I know that you have been part of a sisterhood at Temple Emmanuel for a long time. Tell me about the sisterhood.
The sisterhood did all the scut work. They did all the parties. They raised money for the synagogue. They were the people who did the small jobs. They weren't small, but they were considered small.
Right, the important work that had to get done, but nobody else wanted to do it. Right,
that's exactly what we did.
Tell me about some of the women that you were part of that sisterhood with. What was it like?
I was president of the sisterhood for some time. And we had a lively sisterhood. We had a lot of members. The women at that time did not work, and so their days were usually free. And we had lovely luncheons, and we had celebrations of one kind or another. We invited other churches to come and participate with us. We gave a big, big dinner at the temple, and it was called a smorgasbord. And that went on for many years. And we served 900 people in a day.
Wow.
And the entire congregation helped with that. And I was in charge of the kitchen, which was a huge job. And we had to be very, very careful who we invited to work in the kitchen, because things got pretty hectic. And we wanted to make sure there was nobody in there who was going to lose their cool and start yelling and screaming, which occasionally we had. But it was a huge, huge project, raised a lot of money. We had a gal who came and worked in the kitchen, and she brought her blender. And at the end of the day, she made whiskey sours for all of us. And we were so tired at the end of the day, we didn't know what end was up, but we sure were happy after we had her whiskey sours.
I'll bet as hard as you worked, I bet you made some very close friends.
I did. It was great. It really was. And there was a camaraderie that unfortunately I don't think there is anymore.
You mentioned that you feel like the Jewish community in Davenport was in its heyday in your parents' generation. What do you see now? How have things changed?
Well, number one, we have a much smaller congregation. We only have 10 children in the religious school, and that's because we are occupying a building with the Jewish community in Rock Island. And that's the combined number of children, 10.
Hmm.
I can remember when one of my sons was in confirmation class, there were 25 kids in his class, and so, that is all gone.
Yeah. Why do you think it has dwindled so much?
Well, first of all, I think that a lot of when the younger when my children were growing up, there were no jobs here. And they graduated from college and they left. And that took that generation. And so we are missing that group of people.
You are describing something that I think people in congregations all over the state of Iowa of all different denominations have seen happen. We've talked about the brain drain, young people leaving the state in many different ways, but this sounds really painful. And having to join together with another synagogue, have you felt like Temple Emmanuel itself has been in danger of disappearing?
There has been a great deal of talk for many, many years of combining with a congregation in Rock Island, since both of us are losing members. But that I don't think is going to happen. But we are sharing a building and also sharing a rabbi. Because total, we don't have enough people to support separate buildings. And therefore, I'm hoping that this will work out. It seems so far to be fine. But we are not combining our congregations. We are merely sharing a building.
Yeah. As small as the Jewish community is in your temple and in Davenport now, it still sounds like it's a very important part of your life.
It is.
What would you like people to know about the Jewish community in Iowa, if you could tell everybody one thing?
We're a pretty vibrant, great people. And we make great contributions. And I don't think that we will disappear altogether, but we are definitely shrinking.
Joanne, thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, and thank you for calling me.
Joanne Satin has been a member of Temple Emmanuel in Davenport since 1931. Temple Emmanuel is Iowa's oldest continuously active Jewish congregation. We'll talk more about Jewish history in Iowa in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. As Hanukkah 2021 comes to a close, it ends at sundown today, we are exploring Jewish history in Iowa. Now, there has never been a large population of Jews in the state, but there have been Jewish people here since the 1860s, and some of them have remarkable stories. Jeanette Gabriel is director of the Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and she curated the Jewish Women in Iowa project based at the Iowa Women's Archive at the University of Iowa. Hello, Jeanette.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And tell me what drew you to the study of Jewish people in the Midwest.
Well, I just was really lucky. I was working on my PhD at the University of Iowa, and the Iowa Women's Archives had an opportunity to do a big collection, collecting papers on the history of Jewish women in Iowa, due to a very generous gift from Joan Lipsky from Cedar Rapids, who was a six-term state representative in Iowa between 1967 and 1978, and at the end of her life decided that she wanted to make this contribution to Jewish history to create archival collections that scholars and historians could use.
As I mentioned, there have never been a lot of Jewish people in Iowa, but there have been Jewish people in here since, in the state since the 1860s. And so much of what we see when we look at Jewish history in Iowa, it focuses around when synagogues were founded and, you know, how long they lasted, if they're no longer in operation, or Jewish-owned businesses. But the Women's Archive gives us an opportunity to really look at Jewish history in a different, more personal way.
Right. The contributions that the Jewish communities in Iowa made go far beyond their internal religious life. Even though there's always been a small number of Jews in Iowa, they have lived in many different communities throughout Iowa and have been involved very deeply in the life of the community. And in many ways, through projects that are largely unknown. And part of what I really sought to collect was to flush out those stories so that there would be an opportunity for people to realize that the Jewish community isn't just about synagogue life. It's about all the different ways that Jewish members within the community are contributing to the greater well-being and good of the communities where they lived.
Well, and telling women's stories, I've talked about this on the show in many different ways, but for a long time, women's stories were not included in historical accounts. And especially for a long period of time when women didn't work outside the home, their influence went unseen and unrecognized in so many ways. So that's a big part of this project as well, right?
Sure. And even when they did have a public space, it was not always recognized, like Dora Chapman, who ran the Englert Theater for years, or Marlene Booth, who's a famous filmmaker from Des Moines, who made a film about growing up Jewish in Iowa and has made many other films. There's all these ways that women did professionally contribute outside the home that have gone unnoticed and are deeply rooted in their own experiences within the Jewish family.
When you started looking for these stories, were they difficult to find?
They weren't, because the Jewish community in Iowa was so supportive. I went around the state giving presentations, and people were so generous about sharing their own stories and stories of their mothers. There was a feeling of a real need for these stories to be heard, and the thought that that they haven't been. For example, Mildred Levin from the University of Iowa, who got her PhD in her late 40s and was really committed to assisting non-traditional students and especially women, set up the Saturday and evening class program in the 1970s, which history is largely unknown. And she was so generous about sharing not just her own story, but the memoirs she had written of her mother and what she remembered of her mother singing German songs and telling her about life in Germany.
You are broadening your work now to really focus on the Jewish experience in the Midwest, but focusing on the Jewish experience in Iowa, there, of course, have been these Jewish communities in different places around the state. But then there have also been Jewish people who live in communities where there's not a Jewish community. So in thinking about the Jewish experience over time, tell me more about what you learned about what that must have been like.
Yeah, it's a fascinating dynamic. There's always been sort of the Jewish business in a lot of small towns throughout Iowa. So places where, like Denison, Iowa, for example, where there was the one Jewish family that owned the Jewish business. And that family really had to integrate with the rest of the community and was largely welcomed by the community, though there were certain barriers, which we heard about earlier, in terms of children having opportunities to date. So there were points at which families felt that they had to move on for the well-being often of their children. And then that one Jewish business would be taken on by another Jewish family. So those were challenging circumstances for families to live in. But also they lived very rich lives, and form deep ties with the communities where they were, while also sustaining connections to larger Jewish communities where they would travel for religious services on holidays.
We know that, of course, anti-Semitism is not something that just exists in the United States. So there are a lot of Jewish people who fled their homelands because of anti-Semitism and incredible dangers to them and their families. And, of course, that was part of that European settlement experience in the United States. Can you tell me a little bit about how the Jewish experience evolved before World War II and after World War II in the Midwest?
Sure. This is something that actually I'm giving a presentation on in Iowa City, welcoming the immigrants refugee resettlement in Iowa City for the Iowa Women's Archives Women's History Month event. I'm going to go into more depth. There is a very rich history here in Iowa, not just of refugees coming in the 30s, but also of refugee resettlement in the post-war period. And the refugee resettlement in the post-war period was sponsored by different Jewish communities. So you had the Jewish community in Sioux City, which was the largest in the state, sponsoring refugees coming in, like Martin and Fanny Lebowitz, who came out of concentration camps. Their son, Gordon, who lived his whole life in Sioux City, was born in a displaced persons camp in Germany. And we have a beautiful collection on their family stories donated by their daughter, Ruth, or the Council Bluffs community that sponsored refugees to come and resettle in Council Bluffs, Iowa. And many of those refugees stayed, some moved over to Omaha, and it really encouraged the next generation to be committed to refugee resettlement and welcoming insiders into the community. A largely unknown history in Iowa is the history of Scattergood Hostel in right outside of Iowa City, which was a Quaker hostel, which was set up by the Quakers to bring in refugees during the late 30s and early 40s, and really save the lives of many political leaders who were brought out of Germany and resettled into that hostel in rural Iowa. And there were some, it was supposed to be a model that the Quakers were looking to set up many of these hostels throughout the country. And for a series of reasons connected to disconnects, cultural disconnects between the Quakers and the refugees that were coming out of Germany, and also some local anti-Semitism, the hostel never really got off the ground as a national model, but it is a powerful part of Iowa's history.
I'm talking to Jeanette Gabriel. She is the director of the Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. And she also curated the Jewish Women in Iowa project based at the Iowa Women's Archive at the University of Iowa. We're talking about Jewish history in Iowa right now. And I want to go back to something that our earlier guest, Joanne Satin, said when she talked about her children leaving for opportunities. Now, we know that, of course, there are economic pressures that have led people in previous generations to leave. There are all kinds of forces that lead young people to leave the state of Iowa. I'm curious if there's something else in the Jewish community, though, in Iowa, from your perspective, that might make it hard to keep young Jewish people here?
Well, that's an interesting question, Charity. I think for the most part, what happened is there was a post-war boom, that was the largest population of Jews in Iowa. And then that community of young people went to college. And a lot of the young women joined the Jewish sorority, Sigma Delta Tau, and they were able to meet Jewish men and get married. And in many cases, those connections took them outside the state. It's always difficult when people grow up in small towns to bring them back after a college experience. So I'm not sure that that is singular to the Jewish experience, but I do think that one of the reasons that a lot of the Jewish families moved out of small towns was about the consolidation of the business models into larger stores, which made it unsustainable to run small stores throughout small communities.
You have also said that you feel like it can be hard to be Jewish in the Midwest because you are part of such a small community, or maybe not a community at all.
Right. It is a challenge. You know, I grew up in a small town in Wisconsin, Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, and it was challenging there. I really feel what Joanne said about knowing you're an outsider, knowing that you don't fit in, knowing you don't belong. I've heard that from so many of the women that I've interviewed, that there's just this sense of not fitting into the community, and in many cases, not really fully understanding why as a young person. It is a challenging situation to retain a Jewish identity when there are so few Jews around. On the other hand, I think that it also created wonderful relationships between the small Jewish communities and the rest of Iowa's population, that many Jews felt deeply embraced and accepted in Iowa and loved by the communities where they lived and are very proud to have that Iowa identity.
With the time that we have left, we have about 5 minutes left. I would love to hear more about some of the individuals that you learned about in your process with the Women's Archives. In particular, I know that there was a woman who was very involved in saving those incredible WPA post office murals. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Oh, sure. This is such an amazing story. And, you know, this is the beauty of developing archival collections, is that you stumble across totally unknown stories. So Blanche Redman, who grew up in Davenport, went away to become a professor. And when she retired, she came back. And she was the head of the Association of American University Women group in Iowa. And through that project in the 1970s and 80s, she began to work with women throughout the state to document WPA post office murals all throughout the state, and in some cases really saved murals that were on the brink of destruction. And she documented this whole project, and it was really hands-on organizing work, that local women would go out and find these murals and document them and research the artists that had done them. And she wrote up a whole manuscript, which we have in the archives, of her project, this community-based project, and couldn't find a single publisher who was willing to accept that publication of that document. So it's a really beautiful unknown story here in Iowa.
Oh, wow. And something that we all should be very grateful for as well. Who else should we know about?
Well, you know, one of the things that I really loved is how important Jewish men are in helping tell the history of Jewish women. Somebody I particularly want to mention is Jim Sherman, who currently lives up in Minneapolis. He was a lay leader in Sioux City for Sher Zion and Congregation Beth Shalom for many, many years. And he gave to the archives copies of all the eulogies that he gave at funerals for those congregations. And within those eulogies, he tells beautiful stories of all the women that he knew in the community. And it's this incredible documentation of women's lives that we would never know, that he was so careful to keep and protect for us. So it's little things like that that are so powerful to documenting the history of who we are. And for people to realize that the things that they have in their attics, the things that they don't think have much value, even beyond their own family's history, have tremendous value in terms of telling a broader narrative of who a community is and being able to document it for future generations.
With such a small population of Jewish people in Iowa and the connections that these different synagogues and communities have with each other, do you feel like you've been able to take a comprehensive look at this community?
You know, it's a great question. I think there are so many different individual narratives that it can just seem like a cacophony of different stories. But there are patterns throughout them. deep patterns that really speak to broader national Jewish narratives. And often when the Jewish stories outside of the coasts, out here in the hinterlands is told, it really just focuses on those narrow stories of businesses. But there is a much deeper, richer, complex story that we can see through women's voices, through women's letters, like Gusti Coleman, who came from Vienna in the 1930s and lived her whole life in Mount Vernon, Iowa, recently passed away at the age of 106. Her letters document trying to bring refugees to the United States from throughout the world. These local stories that we have connect us to a broader, richer national and international history. So I think there is a larger comprehensive narrative of how the lives of particularly women, Jewish women here in Iowa, have been part of contributing to our national and international Jewish history and national story.
Well, Jeanette, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Jeanette Gabriel is director of the Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and she curated the Jewish Women in Iowa project based at the Iowa Women's Archive at the University of Iowa. And of course, Hanukkah comes to a close today at sundown, so I know for many people who've been celebrating, the celebrations ended last night, but I hope it was a wonderful and warm Hanukkah. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about spreading the gospel of quilting in the digital age. This is Talk of Iowa.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Mary Fons is a self-described quilt nerd. You may remember her from the PBS program she hosted along with her mother, Marianne Fons, Fons and Porter's love of quilting. After moving on from the program, she has delved deeply into the history of quilting. She is a writer, quilter, and owner of Paper Girl LLC, and she has decided to take quilting into some new territory. You can follow her at Quilt Nerd on YouTube and Twitch, where she streams at least three times a week, and she is on the line with me now. Hello, Mary.
Hi, Charity.
Welcome.
It's good to hear your voice.
Oh, it's lovely to hear you as well. Welcome back to the show. So, all right.
Thank you.
I'm sure that there are many people listening right now who have experience with YouTube. There are probably fewer people who have experience with Twitch. So I think that we should probably define what we're talking about before we get too deep into the conversation. For people who aren't familiar, tell me about Twitch.
Well, to start with, I was unfamiliar with Twitch until about 4 or 5 months ago myself. So I have lots of compassion for everyone who's like, what is this? Why is this on Twitch? Twitch started, 7, 8 years ago or so. And it started primarily as a live streaming platform for gamers, for video gamers to play their games and have people watch them. It's a whole thing people like to do. And so Twitch started out, it's a live streaming platform. That's what it's built for. And until a couple years ago, it was pretty much all video gamers who were using this. But a couple years ago, there started to be different content on Twitch because Twitch is so good at live stream. YouTube does YouTube Lives and Facebook does Facebook Live, Instagram. But Twitch is built for it. And the functionality and the things that it can do and just the quality of the platform is why I thought, well, I think I'm going to try this experiment. And I can tell you more about how that started, but that's what Twitch is. And you don't have to be a video gamer to use Twitch anymore.
All right. Well, and of course, a lot of people do remember you from watching Love of Quilting. And you have also done a great deal of writing and magazine editing and all of that as well. But tell us a little bit, just remind those who may not remember and for those who don't know, even though you grew up with a quilter extraordinaire in your family with your mother, Marianne Fons, you didn't take to quilting super early.
It's true. I didn't make a quilt. I mean, aside from like a doll quilt, when I was a kid with my mom, I didn't really make a quilt until I was in my 20s, my late 20s. quilts were what my mom did for work. And so my sisters and I'm the middle daughter of three girls, and we had a healthy appreciation for quilts, of course, but quilts were, you know, mom was under deadline for a magazine or making pieces for the show. And so we were doing other creative things. But when I was 28, my life got kind of messy. I was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis, a catastrophic situation health-wise. I was married once before, very briefly, sort of doomed. And all of this was kind of happening, you know, at the same time. And what I like to say is I had my quilt epiphany around that time. And I figured out that when your life is torn into a million pieces, it suddenly makes perfect sense to tear up perfectly good fabric into a million pieces and sew it back together again. And so I was like, oh, mom, I want to make a quilt. And I jumped in. I was self-taught, actually, because I didn't sew with mom. So I got put on the show pretty quickly because I was like Fonz the Younger. You know, people were excited that there was this, you know, right. New Fonz.
Another generation.
And mom wanted... Yeah, mom wanted to retire, so it was like, oh, great. But I didn't know how to make quilts because I never really had. And so I learned how to sew on national television. Mm-hmm. I don't recommend it, but
No pressure there at all. And you have become very engaged in quilting history. Tell me about taking that step, because it's one thing to make a quilt, but there is so much history there to explore.
When I first started making quilts, I wanted to make all the quilts, you know, and for many years, several years, I was doing that, making all these quilts. And I trace it back to being at home in Iowa, my home state, and being at mom's house. We were probably at a time when we were filming the show at Iowa Public Television in Des Moines. I'd go home for weeks at a time, you know, while I was doing that taping. And I was looking for inspiration for my next quilt. And of course, my mom has a huge bookcase full of books, you know, on quilting. Some are how-to, some are pattern books and things. But she has a lot of other books, you know, history books, state documentation projects. In the 1980s and 90s, most states in the United States did quilt documentation days where people would bring their quilts from their families, you know, to a church basement or to a VFW hall or whatnot. And people would record, you know, the provenance of these different quilts. And many of the states have made books. So, you know, Georgia quilts and, you know, Alabama quilts and all these different wonderful books exist of these vintage, antique, older quilts. And they're wonderful. And just as your last guest was talking about, you know, these stories, they tell a larger narrative and you know, these pieces of history are so important. Quilts are documents, and they tell such an incredible story. And so when I would look at these different quilt books and the quilts that were pictured, you know, they had stories with each one of them. And I started to understand, like, oh, quilts are way more than just pretty blankets. They're sort of a doorway to pretty much everything you want to know. I mean, if you want to know about a time in American history, just look at a quilt made in that period, and you can really learn a lot in context.
Well, and just as we were talking about earlier, now I know that there are men who quilt and men who quilt very well, but historically speaking, of course, women have been the quilters in our cultures. And so this is a really tangible artifact of women's history, and so much of women's work didn't leave traces.
It's true, and neither did the work of the poor, poor people or working class people. But quilting is a democratic art. You know, anybody can do it. You don't need fancy materials. You don't need a fancy sewing machine. You can use a needle and thread. You know, rich people have made quilts, you know, for centuries. Poor people have made quilts for centuries. It just something that's available to everybody. And so since everybody makes quilts, you know, it doesn't discriminate toward people who, you know, don't have, maybe who couldn't even write down their family history, right? But they could make quilts, and then it holds some of that history for them. But absolutely, I mean, women have been the quilt makers in America for so long. And our history is in the quilts that we make, without a doubt. And many of them aren't signed. You know, Virginia Woolf said anonymous was a woman. You know, and so if a quilt is made by anonymous or an unidentified artist, you know, it's probably because it was made by a woman. And people didn't sign quilts so often for a long time. But But some of them did, and the stories that you get from those quilts are always remarkable.
So you have been writing and spreading the quilt gospel for a long time now, since you had your quilt epiphany. Tell me about your Twitch epiphany. What made you think, I need to be talking about quilting on Twitch?
Well, there's a journalist I really like, and I listened to a podcast or something that she was doing. Maybe she was a guest on a podcast, and she was saying how she live streams her research on Twitch, and she's like in her 20s, you know, so she's on Twitch. I'm 42, so I was not on Twitch, but but I was so curious about this, and so I tuned into this Twitch channel, and it was fascinating. She was sharing her screen. And she was there on camera down in the corner, you know, so you could see her. And she's going through different videos and looking at different material that she was using for a different story, you know. And she was kind of going down the rabbit hole of her research. And there's a chat box, you know, and everybody who's watching is chatting and sort of contributing, or maybe they have an idea or they're having side conversations about the topic. And I'm so curious about quilts. I mean, the rabbit hole, that's where I live. I live in the quilt rabbit hole because I'm lecturing and I'm writing articles about quilts and I'm working on a documentary. And so I'm in the rabbit hole all the time. And I find these wonderful things. Like I was just thinking about, there's this quilt at the Jewish Museum in New York City that is absolutely gorgeous. It's from 1899. It's so beautiful. And I find stuff like that and I put it in my files. And like, I hope it'll get into a lecture at some point, but what if it doesn't? You know, it'll be years maybe before the documentary is ready. And so I have this huge cache of beautiful, amazing quilt stuff. And so I thought, well, why don't I just be curious in public with Twitch? You know, why don't I live stream my research just like that? And anybody who wants to nerd out on quilts with me can watch, and we can talk about it, and we can sort of let my fingers do the walking. And I started 4 months ago and zero quilters were on Twitch pretty much. So I have like 400 followers and I'm so proud of it because almost everybody who watches the show has had to make a Twitch, you know, Twitch login, and the quilters are amazing. They're really tech savvy. They get the rap for not being that way, but in fact, they're super early adopters to a lot of technology. But yeah, that's how it started.
Well, and when I saw that you were on Twitch, I thought, she's making quilts on Twitch? That doesn't sound very convenient, because of course you'll have to have access to your computer and you're trying to sew things at the same time. So that is not what's going on. So this is just really an in-depth intellectual conversation and exploration of quilts that you are live streaming.
Yeah, and what's so great about this particular format, that someone called it a video magazine, and I really like that. It's, of course, I love radio. I love, you know, Iowa Public Radio. Radio is amazing, obviously. But with a live stream, you have this visual component. And so when I'm talking about, you know, that Jewish quilt, that Russian-American quilt at the Jewish Museum, we can see it together and I can zoom in. And it's so funny. I mean, the nerds, you know, all the quilt nerds who are watching the show, who tune in three times a week, you know, I zoom in and we're talking about construction. It's like, okay, is that applique? Like, no, how did she do that? Like, oh, wow. You know, this is amazing. And people are do it differently. You know, maybe she did this, maybe she did that, but we get to look at things, and that's kind of the difference between other formats that have existed for quilters, you know, different media that exist for quilters. This is different.
Well, it sounds just very, present, very engaging. And in a time when so many of us have been isolated, this sounds like a really lovely community experience. But it also sounds like, I would guess, that deep quilt nerds are spread out all over the world. So this is a great place for you to come together.
It's true. We have some people. There's a woman in Singapore, a few people in Germany. I'm in London right now, going to be going home to Chicago soon for the holiday. But, you know, there a couple people tune in at like 2 a.m. But see, quilters, a lot of times, if we're working on a quilt, we work all night. Like, we can't put it there, you know, for the night owls, you know, who need something on for company. And the shows are on average about 2.5 hours because we're talking, we're looking at stuff. And then if someone says, you know, oh, this is a great, you know, I saw this quilt or something, I can click on it and we can look at it together. So it's this conversation. It really is. And the researcher that I liked, she's pretty, you know, pretty quiet. She's clicking through things and she'll engage with the people in the chat room. But I really am, you know, Charity, I'm really that host, that TV gal. So it's really a show.
Yeah.
It's a show and I'm talking with people and yeah.
So what does it do for you? I can understand what this does for your viewers and the people who dive into that conversation. What does it give you?
Well, I was watching a documentary type show yesterday, actually, about a music producer, and he's such a nerd. Like I was thinking, like, wow, this really successful music producer, he's on top of the world, he's doing, but he's really nerdy about music, about music production, and I loved that, and I really it sort of hit home for me, because anybody who really loves a topic, who is going to get into the like arcane details and like really deep history and really think hard about like this particular thing, one thing, it's really rewarding. And it's very, it gives back to me, because the more I look at this quilt, you know, from this particular museum, or I uncover a quilt in a book and talk about it, I get to learn more about the world that I live in. And to be a nerd means to really think hard about what you love. And if you spend so much time thinking about what you love and why you love it, that's a great place to be. And so I'm curious about everything. I'm curious about philosophy, economics. I'm curious about art and fashion. And quilts touch everything. Whether a quilt is art or not is a really good question. And so you're kind of talking about, you know, the philosophy of art at a certain point. What is art? What is the difference between art and craft? I love questions like that. I love to be curious about things like that. And quilts take me there. And how much should a quilt cost? You know, this is an economic question. It's really hard to put a price on a quilt. I call them priceless, worthless objects, because in a family that has a quilt, you know, that's generations old, you wouldn't part with it for any dollar amount. But if you tried to sell it in the market, you wouldn't get very much for it. How is that possible? So you have these really big questions, and quilts lead the way to those questions. And I love nerding out about quilts, because I get to be curious about everything I want to be curious about, and quilts take me there. And it's always an adventure. It really is.
So you are attracting quilt nerds, people who are already care about quilts, to this different way of interacting with you. Do you also find, I mean, obviously there are a lot of young people on Twitch, there are a lot of young people who spend a lot of time on YouTube, and the quilters in our society tend to be older. Are you attracting younger people and turning them on to this artwork?
Yeah. We have one guy who comes to the show regularly. He's a tattoo artist. So he was on Twitch and he just happened to click on my show when it was live. And he's at almost every show. And he said the other day, he's like, I have no idea like how I got here, but I keep coming to the show because the content is so good. I was curious about, somehow it came up, the Carter family, you know, the wonderful music of the Carter family. I've always wondered if Sarah Carter, if those quilts exist, because I read once that she made quilts. And so we nerded out on the Carter family and Johnny Cash and finding the quilts in that story. And it was very exciting, learning about the quilts that Sarah Carter did make. And this tattoo artist said, well, you hit on something that I love. I love, you know, American roots country music. So, you know, once again, like the quilts have delivered like this really great show. I never thought I'd be watching this, but I love it. And you talked about, you know, some of my favorite musicians somehow. Yeah. So we do have people who are not connected to quilts who are watching. And yeah, I mean, I could have done this on YouTube. I could have started on YouTube only, but Twitch is like, it's the next thing, you know. Facebook kind of gave way to Instagram. YouTube, I think more Twitch people will be on next. Twitch in the future.
All right. Yeah. Well, Mary Fons, thank you so much for talking with me today.
It's a pleasure, Charity. It's good to talk to you.
Mary Fons, you can follow her at Quilt Nerd on YouTube and Twitch, where she streams at least 3 times a week. This is Talk of Iowa.